Hey, welcome to Hellbent, a feminist podcast for those who resist and persist. I'm Devin.
And I'm Julie.
And this is Julie Balutis, who is at Resisterhood. She's been on our show before, actually. You may remember her as talking about the Virginia governor's race. And she is stepping in for Sarah, who is still out sick. So thank you for being here, Julie.
I'm delighted to be here. I'm not delighted that Sarah's still not feeling well, and I hope she is good to go soon. But I am happy to be here with you.
I know. I talked to her on the phone for like an hour this morning, and I was like, you need to come back to me.
Yeah.
I miss you.
Yeah.
This is not working. For me.
Yeah, there's a imbalance in the force when it's not you two together.
Exactly. I was like, come on, Sarah. But no, she's doing a lot better. So, you know, we're all sending her good healing thoughts.
Yes, we are.
And so, Julie, you just got back from something ridiculous. What did you do?
I did. It was ridiculous. I did several days of the Charlottesville to DC march. I joined up with them as they got closer to Northern Virginia and spent a couple of days just walking the roadways up to DC, fighting white supremacy along the way. And there was plenty of white supremacy to be fought along the way.
Sure.
I can't imagine. I heard stories of how it was in the more southern parts of the state, where, you know, they had gunmen waiting for them at rest stops and
wow.
things like that. By the time I joined, it's relatively northern, still a little red, but more the type of troll that will kind of follow you with a sign that says save our statues versus a guy with a long gun waiting for you to, you know, stop and go to the bathroom. So overall, it was just a really great experience. And I was so happy to be able to do it.
Yeah, that's amazing. And also terrifying. I didn't realize that it was that kind of
Yeah,
situation.
They had a lot of security threats along the way. Starting in Charlottesville, you're in a really, really red part of the state.
Right.
And when I was last on the podcast, we talked a lot about how people think Virginia is blue now.
Right.
And in, you know, state level and national races, we normally are, but the state is still very, very red. We
right.
have terrible gun laws. We have a lot of Confederate nostalgia horrors just
yeah.
clogging up our roadways here. So
wow.
it was really disturbing to hear some of those stories. I was glad that it kind of fizzled out by the time I got to the more northern parts of the state, but
yeah.
really scary stuff for a lot of them having to deal with that.
That is really scary. Wow.
Mm-hmm.
But amazing that you did. I'm honestly in awe. We were asking Julie to be a guest host, and she was like, I didn't see your messages because I was doing this amazing thing. And I was like, seriously, don't worry about it.
Like, okay. I forgot to turn the push notifications on. I was really trying to conserve battery
yeah.
along the way. So
that's great.
So I can just push a video here and there.
Exactly. yeah. So let's go over what we're going to talk about really fast, and then we will jump right in. So first off, as always, is listener feedback and general updates. And then block two, we're actually going to talk about DACA and Trump's DACA, like what's going on with that. I don't even have a really good joke for that. And then block three, we actually have an interview with Lauren Duca, and we're so excited to talk to her. It should be really, really interesting. So that'll be great. Block four is our gratitude check, as always. And then block five, it's Thursday, so we get to do another Hellion of the Week. And since we didn't do a first episode this week, I haven't done a Dickwad of the Week yet, so it all feels very positive. It's great.
Yeah, that's great. I mean, there are plenty of Dickwads,
oh, there
but
are.
Let's just celebrate the Hellions
exactly.
this week.
And then block six, finally, we have action items, so something you can do after you listen to the show. Okay, Julie, so let's jump right in to listener feedback. So what is our first piece of feedback?
So our first piece of listener feedback is from Colleen, who tweeted, so happy to hear that Illinois, my state, won Hellion of the Week. Also, thanks for all the substantive info you provide on the pod.
Oh, I mean, I love stuff like that. It really...
Yeah, I love hearing the feedback you guys get. It's fun to read it. I can't take any credit for it, but I'm like, oh, yes, I'm so happy for that, too, as a listener.
That's amazing. And then on the flip side, Jennifer tweeted, please don't give Governor Rauner credit for Illinois' awesome. He bankrupted Illinois by refusing budgets because of his personal anti-union interests. To which I say, fair enough. Also, from what I understand, he vetoed the original bill to disallow gay panic defense. So let's not say it was him specifically, but rather the state of Illinois who won Hellion of the Week. And he was just sort of along for the ride.
Fair enough.
Yeah.
Fair enough.
Okay. Last we have Cassidy via email, and she says, I just listened to episode 55, Hurricane Trump, and I just wanted to drop you a quick note. Your action items related to Hurricane Harvey involved blood donations, and you mentioned donating blood if you were on the ground in Texas. I just wanted to let you know that blood donations anywhere are helpful during natural disasters and other mass casualty events. I work at a hospital blood bank in Colorado, so I can give you some insight as to why. We have our own blood donor center, so 95% of our blood inventory comes from local donors. However, when our inventory starts to get low, we have to order blood products from a major supplier in Denver. That supplier is able to ship blood products across state lines when a disaster happens elsewhere to supplement that area's blood supply. We can't ship across state lines. So when our inventory is stable due to generous donors in our area, we're using less of the blood that's potentially able to get where it needs to go during a disaster anywhere else. There are similar situations all over the country. If you could maybe keep this in mind for future blood donation action items, it would really help out those of us in the field and the patients we ultimately serve.
That's a great note, and I'm really glad that someone could clarify that, because it is always great to donate blood, and I love the sort of intricacies of why it's important, even if you're not exactly where it needs to go. So
yeah,
it's really great. And then quickly, we have a couple of updates. So first, I just want to say, so this is our first episode with the new setup. I was just telling Julie about how fancy and amazing our mic setup is around here. And again, this is all thanks to our patrons. And then for those of you who support us at the $5 and up level on Patreon, we are planning an epic bonus podcast on Hillary Clinton's new book. That shit is pre-ordered, and we're going to have a nice long discussion about it. And you won't want to miss it, mostly because I will probably be drinking wine while we do it. So you
can I co-host that one?
I know, right? I want to do that one. So you can support us at patreon.com/hellbentpodcast if you want to get in on that bonus pod. And then next, quickly, we have a sadish announcement. We're officially breaking up with SoundCloud. The platform just isn't working for us, unfortunately, and we've decided that we're going to stop updating it permanently. So if you use SoundCloud to listen to us, we are on tons of other platforms, and you can find us on iTunes, Google Play, Radio Public, Spotify, and your favorite podcast app. And if you need help finding us, you can reach out on Twitter or email or Facebook or Carrier Pigeon or whatever. We can help you.
Owl.
You know, whatever. Like, I pretend I live in Harry Potter anyway. It's fine. And then we are excited to announce, this is really exciting, that we are doing a special crossover podcast with the brilliant ladies of Pantsuit Politics, Beth and Sarah. So tune in on Thursday, September 21st, for all four of us talking news, feminism, and gratitude. It's going to be a lot of fun, and we're really excited. So definitely don't want to miss
Yay.
That. Okay, and then finally, we have something sad. One of our listeners, Mare, passed away this weekend. His friend Dylan reached out to us about his GoFundMe after he was diagnosed with leukemia, and we had had an action item about it. And we are sad to say that he lost his battle. So Dylan wrote a beautiful tribute, and I'm honored to read. So Dylan said, "Whenever someone dies young, people talk about how much that person gave and still had left to give. But for our fellow Hellion, Mare O'Brien, I cannot stress how true this is. Mare's battle with leukemia came to an end Friday night. In his 20 years on Earth, he touched countless lives. I can't even begin to describe the impact he had on my life, but I can try. Mare found me in a pretty dark place, and knowing him for 2 years and being able to call him my best friend was the best thing ever to happen to me. So many good things in my life come from him, including my interest in feminist politics and Hellbent. His pushing me in the direction of feminist politics, as well as his instilling of self-confidence in me, allowed me to land an internship with Emily's List this past summer, easily the greatest experience of my professional life. He also introduced me to Hellbent when, one day about 6 months ago, he said, 'Hey, there's this podcast that's exactly our political niche. It's just two feminists ranting about how much Trump and Bernie suck.' Mare and I spent countless hours in our dorm room listening to Hellbent and talking about it. Mare is proof positive that we straight white men aren't all dickwads. I intend to dedicate the rest of my life to honoring him, including his passion for feminist politics." So I think Sarah and I would both just like to say thank you for allowing us to be part of your story, and we are so sorry for your loss. Okay, Julie, so let's jump into DACA and what's going on with the Trump administration and what they've done with DACA. So can you tell us a little bit about what's going on?
I can. Yes. Yesterday, the Trump administration, obviously not Trump himself, because that would involve some level of bravery or courage, which we all know he has none of.
Right.
He had his attorney general end DACA, leaving 800,000 Dreamers vulnerable to deportation. This would go into place in 6 months, and there's a lot wrong with it. But one of the more cowardly aspects, as we already said, is that he didn't do it himself,
right,
but he had Jefferson Beauregard Sessions the fucking third do it for him.
Seriously,
and
I hate
also
that.
Ridiculous. I mean, yeah, no, seriously.
I hate that. Ugh. Like, if you're going to do something, like, own it. If you're going to be a shitty person, own it. Hate that.
Yeah, it's awful. And ridiculous, but not surprising, is that he doesn't seem to understand the full scope of what his decision will do. So Kyle Griffin, an MSNBC producer, tweeted, "Remarkable detail via New York Times. Hour before DACA news, officials weren't sure Trump fully grasped what he was about to do, with a screenshot of the following tidbit from the New York Times article. As late as 1 hour, 1 hour
yeah,
before
1 hour.
The decision was to be announced, administration officials privately expressed concern that Mr. Trump might not fully grasp the details of the steps he was about to take."
I just, that to me is just so insulting. This is why the presidency is not a fucking entry-level position, right?
Yep.
I mean,
yep.
If you don't understand what you're doing or why you're doing it or how it works, you don't get to fucking make these decisions. It's horrible.
No, they impact people's livelihoods and lives. It's disgusting. It's wrong. I am not very eloquent about it because I'm very emotional about it.
Right.
But the fact that he didn't understand what he was doing is just icing on an insulting shit cake that nobody should have to eat. Nobody should have to pick up a fork and eat that. It's awful.
It's so true. I mean, he just the anti-intellectualism and the cruelty coupled with the ignorance is really just such a grinding combination. It just makes my skin crawl.
Yeah.
And so, you know, Jefferson didn't take questions during his little press conference. So now, why would he? So Vivian Yee, who's the New York Times immigration journalist, she has an epic thread of exactly what this decision means, because Sessions wouldn't give any context. So I'm just going to read a few lowlights here. So basically, DHS will process new DACA applications that have been received as of today on a case-by-case basis, but won't take new ones after today. So in 2018, over 275,000 people are set to have DACA expire. Of those, about 7,300 have applied for DACA renewal. And so ICE says that they won't target DACA holders. They're still prioritizing criminals / people already ordered removed. But people who lose DACA will be treated like anyone else in the country illegally, putting them at risk for deportation under Trump. And so what this means in the short term is anyone whose DACA expires on 3/16/18 or later and hasn't applied to renew will be at risk. And we're also going to link to the full memo that ends the DACA program in our show notes. So just so you, if you, you know, want to pick up that fork and eat that shit cake and read that, please be my fucking
If you're
guest.
Craving a shit cake.
If you're craving a shit cake, I got that. I got you.
Yeah. Yeah. So like we talked about, I was on the Charlottesville DC march while Sessions gave the address about rescinding DACA. And we actually, while we were walking, it, you know, it was hot. We were walking under a bridge and they put it on over the megaphones just so we could kind of be up on the latest news and be sure that, you know, we weren't behind on anything as we walked. And I have to say, just hearing his voice, which I remember someone on Twitter once describing as sounding like a whites only drinking fountain come to life. And it does. I mean, that's exactly what he sounds like.
Beautiful metaphor I've ever heard in my life.
Yeah. So, and to hear that while we were marching against white supremacy with a group that's predominantly people of color, some of whom are Dreamers, just, it made my blood run cold. It made my heart sick. It truly sounded like something you'd hear in 1930s Germany. The dehumanizing language he uses to describe immigrant children who have grown up to be productive, contributing, vital members of our society just sickened me to my very core.
Yeah.
And when I got home and I was able to actually catch up on the news beyond just, you know, this inhuman voice over a megaphone taking the humanity away from these people who were brought here as children and who are doctors and lawyers and nurses and contributing in so many ways, I actually saw the footage of him kind of smugly walking in to give that speech. And he looked so happy,
right?
Devin. He looked so happy.
Isn't that just so disgusting? He did. He looked like a kid on Christmas, you know?
Yeah. And, you know, I hate caricaturizing him. Like, I hate the Keebler elf description and all of that. But you see him and he really is just a tiny little racist man. It's not surprising at all to see him look happy about that. But it's still just really disturbing and a great reminder that white supremacy is absolutely his life's work. Like, he takes pride in it. It drives him. He goes to sleep at night dreaming of a world where we're all white and white people have all the power. That is his utopia. And let's just take a second to wrap our minds around the fact that this person put up with weeks of humiliating Trump tweets and public mockery, all because he didn't want to miss the chance to stand in front of America and make that statement to get back into Trump's ear and convince him that deporting 800,000 DACA recipients is just a great fucking idea.
That's such a good fucking point, right? Like, why would you put up with that humiliation if not because this is like your deepest, darkest dream come to life?
You picture him just in a dark room somewhere, just him and Stephen Miller, just it'll all be worth it in the end. We'll get to end DACA. We'll get to kick the immigrants out. And that's, oh God, it's just awful. And when I picture Stephen Miller, that little creep, who wrote, you know, he wrote a lot, if not all, of that statement, standing behind the curtain, grinning and pressing his index fingers together like Monty Burns. it fills me with this rage I can't even describe.
Yeah.
The joy these people get out of destroying brown and black lives is just senseless and unfathomable.
It is. It is just so gross to see them take such pleasure. Jeff Sessions is a person who was denied a federal judgeship because he was too racist in the fucking 80s.
Like, in the 80s.
Like, if you're too racist in the 80s, like, what the hell are you doing with your life?
Yeah. And you're definitely too racist now. You were always too racist.
Yeah.
And the entire premise these people use against DACA is the false narrative that DACA recipients are, you know, quote unquote, using our resources or taking our benefits. And they're not.
Right.
They're not eligible for SSI or Medicaid or ACA or FAFSA or food stamps or any other federal aid programs. At the state level, maybe that's different.
Right.
State rights are these people's jam anyway. I mean,
it's interesting how many states' rights are all of a sudden like, no, federal government only when it comes to stuff like this.
So, I mean, these people are paying into a system that they're getting virtually nothing back from.
Right.
Other than ostensibly a country to call home. So taking that one thing away from them is just unconscionable.
Well, and you have to ask yourself why. Obviously, we know the answer. It's racism. It's the xenophobia. But like 800,000 people... It's Einstein's theory of relativity, right? So 800,000 people is a lot of people. But when you're looking at like the overall numbers, that number is tiny, right? It's less than a million people in the overall picture. It's a lot of lives to be affected right now. But they can't possibly be, well, they are, but they're arguing that this is going to help solve the immigration quote unquote problem.
No, it's about 1/30th of the people they wanted to take health care away from.
Right, exactly. So it's really God. To put that in context, Jesus.
Not a big piece of the pie.
Right.
And there's really no rationale for doing this other than to continue to build racial strife, which is literally the only thing this administration does consistently.
True.
And the American people don't want this.
Right.
DACA's popular on many sides, on all sides.
Many sides.
72% of fucking Republicans support a path to citizenship for these folks. So when you're talking about almost 3/4 of Republicans saying, hey, we like DACA, you know, don't rescind it. Give these people a path to live here legally permanently. What are you doing?
Well, yeah, it's kind of like what do you kick puppies for fun? How is this politically beneficial? Right. If so many people like it.
Yeah. I mean, there are bills in Congress right now that in the House and the Senate that have bipartisan support to give these people permanent residence and a path to citizenship.
Right.
And it's nonsensical. It's nothing more than the opportunity to make a statement, to continue to build hate and strife and hurt brown and black people.
Yeah. It's just disgusting because that's so obviously the rationale. There's just no defense. Mm-hmm. And the other kind of the other side, well, not other side, but part of this is the fact that, you know, the DACA data collection, used to apply for DACA, is poised to be weaponized against those who applied in the past, which is exactly what people were worried about. I mean, this was a whole fucking thing where people were like, oh, my God, they could actually weaponize this information. And now here we are. You know, what, 6 months into this presidency and it's already happening. It's just awful. And because, you know, so there was this really great Daily Beast article about it. And they explained that in order to win a deportation hearing, the government must prove that the person they are trying to deport did actually enter the country illegally. And that can prove to be a difficult thing. But with these detailed records given willingly to the government by the person facing deportation, it's clear that they are in the country, quote unquote, illegally. And you can't see me, but I'm making exasperated air quotes around that.
I see. Yeah, I will vouch for Devin. They're very exasperated. There's a lot of fingers waving around. And yeah, I wish you guys could see it. But yeah, it's such a breach of trust. And to ask these folks to trust the government in the first place was a really big ask, right? To say, give the government your personal information, give the government that could deport you information that would allow them to deport you and trust them to not use it against you.
Yeah.
And they did that. And it's blowing up in their faces, and it's just
And this is part of the thing about the Trump presidency. People always say, oh, we're gonna get through it, we're gonna live through it, but like, this has damaged an integral pillar of trust between citizens and the government, and that is very difficult to repair, if not impossible. And so it does go beyond Trump and this administration and these racist policies, because it's breaking something really important. And I mean, that to me is one of the scariest things about this. I mean, because if you think about it, so the DACA applications include information about where the person lives, works, and goes to school. So it also makes it easy for the government to find them, right? Mm-hmm. Because they literally have a database of everyone's address and phone number and where they go to school and what their favorite fucking color is. And so basically the full memo that repeals DACA or, you know, kind of ends DACA states, quote, information provided to USCIS in DACA requests will not be proactively provided to ICE and CBP for the purpose of immigration enforcement proceedings unless the requester meets the criteria for issuance of a notice to appear or referral to ICE under the criteria set forth in USCIS's notice to appear guidance. So all of that mumbo jumbo basically means that USCIS, which is the United States Citizenship and Immigration Service, will not provide DACA information like outright, but will hand it over to ICE if asked.
Yeah, which is honestly kind of fucked. It's just legal mumbo jumbo that says you can have it, especially when we know that ICE has been weaponized to an extent that it never has been before. Right. ICE is trying to weaponize local police forces against immigrants and people of color. And if they continue to act as they have and kind of hunt down immigrants in churches and hospitals and courtrooms,
schools, when they're dropping.
Absolutely. There's no chance that ICE is not going to get this information if they want it. So it's pretty horrific.
Way
to sugarcoat it.
Right. And so in practice, that means that, you know, DACA recipients are more likely to be targeted if they interact with the police in any way. You know, arrests and other reports trigger alerts to all sorts of government agencies, including ICE. Leon Fresco, who's an immigration attorney who represents many DACA recipients, said, quote, if people go back in the shadows and don't have any interactions with law enforcement of any kind, their likelihood of being removed is not high. The key is doing everything you can to avoid interactions with the police. But the problem with this is that pushing people into the shadows is cruel and fucking unhelpful. I mean, crime reporting goes down, community trust evaporates, and we just get fucking nowhere as a country.
Yeah, absolutely. And on top of that, it's really easy to say, you know, try to avoid interactions with the police, but the police are actively profiling these people. The police work to arrest and harm these people.
Right.
And they're working in conjunction with ICE in a lot of cities across the country.
Yeah.
So I'm going to give you an example. My mother volunteers at a Catholic charity that it's called Matthew 25. It gives, you know, clothing and home goods for free to people in need. Mm-hmm. And in my community, that's largely Latino. Mm-hmm. And nobody comes out anymore. They're afraid to leave their houses.
Right.
They're afraid that if they come to church and, you know, try to pick up some clothing or bed linens or pots and pans, they're going to be picked up by ICE. And it's a disgusting abuse of power.
That's all there is to it. And, you know, you hear these reports of ICE agents being at churches, at schools, mm-hmm. at community centers. So it's not like it's just like, oh, don't get arrested. It's not that fucking simple. And
don't go to the grocery store. Don't go to church.
Right.
Don't pick up your kids at school. Don't send your kids to school. Where does it end?
Exactly.
Don't go to the hospital to give birth.
Exactly. Right? Exactly. And so it really just becomes like a really like isolating and mm-hmm. cruel facet of this on top of everything else. And I really think that it highlights Trump's lack of pivot again. You know, back in February, after the inauguration, Trump boasted of a big heart and that he would protect groups like DACA recipients. And he also promised during his campaign to protect LGBT communities and, you know, all of these other like minority groups. And people believed that bullshit. And I'm here to tell those people, quote, from me, I told you so with a capital fuck you.
Like, I second your capital fuck you and raise you double middle finger birds directly at everyone who believed that, because
so many people were like, oh, this is just the candidate. He's going to be different. He's going to be pivot. He's going to pivot. Fuck that.
There will never be a pivot.
No.
There's not going to be a pivot. There hasn't been a pivot. Not shitting yourself in public or during a speech or reading successfully off a teleprompter once or twice is not a pivot.
Absolutely.
There is no pivot.
There's no pivot.
You
it's not coming.
Cannot run a campaign where you call Mexicans rapists and then tell people you have a big heart and you'll protect them.
Right.
Like,
no. No. Well, and there's another, like, kind of a left turn into a, you know, tangent, but, you know, I know someone in my family, I'm not going to call out who specifically, but, you know, I was talking to this person about how Trump had called Mexicans rapists, and she was like, no, he didn't. And I was like, what? Yeah. She's like, no, they took it out of context. I was like, no, there's no context. Like, that actually happened. That is a reported, recorded thing that he said. And there's no context to it. There's no broader ideological anything. That's all he said.
Yeah, no. And it goes right back to, you know, grabbing women by the pussy. It's all on tape. He told us who he was.
Right.
People who want to believe otherwise have a larger problematic ideology that they are allowing to just color their interpretation of anything he says and explain it away so they can, you know, further what they feel is his good agenda.
Exactly. And it's very frustrating. I mean, and just I want to say what he said specifically for posterity's sake. So any historians in the future listening to this, I'm just going to throw this out there.
The seat right here.
Yeah, exactly. So he said, I'm going to use all the pauses too. We're going to show great heart. DACA is a very, very difficult subject for me. You have these incredible kids in many cases. They were brought here. We are going to deal with DACA with heart because, you know, I love these kids. I love kids. I have kids and grandkids. To which I say, what the fuck are you talking about, number one? And it's just like that was something that he said, and it was, you know, people believed that, but they didn't believe that he said that Mexicans were rapists. So go figure that one out.
And I'll throw out there that he has, how many kids? He has five kids, right?
Five kids, yeah.
And yeah, four of them were born to immigrants.
Yes.
I whatever.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, what do you, like, yeah.
Yeah, cool.
Cool, well done.
So while we're talking about pivots that aren't really pivots, the same day that Trump sent Jeffy Bobo out to announce the end of DACA, he tweeted that he'll, quote unquote, revisit the issue if Congress can't pass legislation on it within the 6-month period. You can just fucking ask them to work on a bill rather than playing political hot potato with people's lives. I mean, this is not big-hearted. No. There's nothing about this that's big-hearted. This is the Grinch with his tiny little shriveled black
banana
piece
heart.
Of coal heart. Yeah. Yeah, whatever it is at the beginning. It never grows. It's ridiculous to pretend that this is a way to pressure Congress to pass legislation about this. The DREAM Act has been in Congress off and on for 16 years.
Right.
If you actually care about the future of these kids, you would just work with Congress to get them to pass that bill.
Right. I think a big power of the president that I remember talking about in my, 10th grade civics class was, you know, the power of the press, the bully pulpit. You know, a big part of the power there is being able to put pressure on Congress and be able to get the media and the people behind you. So if he really fucking cared, like, go twist some arms, like, you know, be like, I want someone to work on a DACA bill. Like, do that. But doing this is just it's just cruel. There's just no, it's just cruel.
Yeah. The heartache and fear he's causing people is just, there's no rationale for it. No. He's been doing it since day one. He's been doing it since his campaign. It's not new. It never gets less sickening.
It doesn't. It really doesn't.
And it's not big-hearted. I'll just reiterate that again.
Not big-hearted. Yeah. And, you know, it's just interesting. Obama has put out a statement basically on what's going on. And so to kind of split screen what Trump is saying with someone who's actually big-hearted, you know, Obama's statement was, immigration can be a controversial topic. We all want safe, secure borders and a dynamic economy, and people of goodwill can have legitimate disagreements about how to fix our immigration system so that everybody plays by the rules. But that's not what the action that the White House took today is about. This is about young people who grew up in America, kids who study in our schools, young adults who are starting careers, patriots who pledge allegiance to our flag. These dreamers are American in their hearts, in their minds, in every single way but one, on paper. And, you know, Obama wasn't perfect. They called him the deporter in chief for a reason. But at least he cared. And at least he said what he was going to do. And then he did it, you know?
Yep.
And it just, it's hard. It's just, it makes me so sad that we had this and now we have this.
Yeah. And, you know, there's a whole legal argument about DACA and the legality of it. But I'm not a lawyer. I will not pretend to be a lawyer.
Right.
I will say there's probably an argument to be made that it was a different use of executive power that was taken because he had a very problematic Congress who would not work with him on anything.
Right.
But if your motivation is to resolve the executive overreach, again, I'll just reiterate, you work with Congress to legislate it.
Right.
You don't rescind it and put these people's lives and futures here at risk.
Right. And I think it's a little rich, too, him complaining about overuse of executive orders and executive power when the only fucking thing he's done since taking office is sign a whole bunch of bullshit executive orders that have done nothing.
Yeah. So all he does is, he signs executive orders that reverse Obama's executive orders.
Right.
He signs other dumb ones that don't really do anything.
Right.
Yeah. Awesome. Overreach.
Yeah, seriously. So we have Lauren Duca here with us, and we are very excited to talk to her. Unfortunately, because Sarah is still out sick, it's just me. So hopefully this is a fun interview to listen to. So Lauren Duca is a prolific writer with bylines in Teen Vogue, The Nation, New York Magazine, and Huffington Post, just to name a few. She is also a regular contributor to MSNBC and CNN. In addition to being wickedly smart, Lauren is one of the funniest people I follow on Twitter. We are so lucky to have her on the show today. So welcome, Lauren.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Yeah, this is so great. I know a lot of our listeners are so excited about this interview.
I'm excited, and I'm sad that Sarah's not here.
I know,
because it's really important to me that Sarah quotes my column every week and shares it on Twitter.com, but she always picks quotes that, like, I wasn't even proud of. And right. I'm like, wait, that's the main quote. And she knows it every time. And I just feel like she knows my heart.
Oh, completely. I know. I always say it, but like Sarah's the smartest person I know. So she always gets Sarah. Right to the heart of it. Okay. So I first want to start by talking a little bit about your piece, Donald Trump is Gaslighting America, which came out in December of 2016, but it went viral after the election. And can you kind of explain what gaslighting is and how Trump employed the tactic both as a candidate and now as the president?
Yeah, so to gaslight is to psychologically manipulate a person to the point where they doubt their own sanity. So it's sort of like lying on steroids. And we saw it throughout the campaign with not just deception and contradicting himself, but sort of sending out aides to scramble the conversation, right. Putting out different narratives and claiming that they were all the truth. And I mean, right now, we see it constantly in micro levels and far more macro ones. And I think DACA is probably the best/absolute worst most recent example, because he's performing this anguish. First of all, he's acting as if he is so tormented by this decision, as if he doesn't dole out executive action, like he's writing constitutional fan fiction, right. He is constantly abusing the power of this office,
yeah.
And if he gave a shit about Dreamers, they would be set up at Mar-a-Lago, so right. Don't it's bullshit. And then I think the other part of that whole the complexity with DACA is the legal intricacies. We're acting like this is about rule of law, right. And the reality is that there are 12 million people in this country without legal status. All that DACA does, deferred action, it's right there in the name, it pushes these young people who have volunteered their information, who are students or who are employed and who are the embodiment of what it means to hope for a better life in this country, and it pushes them to the back of the line because we just don't have the resources to kick out 12 million people.
Right.
And I think that we're obscuring it about being about rule of law and immigration. And it's so many levels of lying and so many levels of confusion when it truly is this compassionless assertion of white supremacy, yeah. Again, by this administration.
Right, right. I also find it interesting that in his statement about DACA, he said the reason he's repealing it or ending the program is because Obama did it through executive order and that kind of circumvented the law. And
right,
I'm like,
right.
Listen, asshole, like you're the guy who all you do is sign executive orders that do nothing. So
but he thinks that his power is like tweeting like hashtag trans ban and then that's gonna be law. So
right.
Like, give me a break.
Yeah. No, it's a really, really good point. Yeah, like what is this like Twitter policy thing? That really confuses me.
Yeah.
Like on a like very like base level. And actually kind of on that vein though, one of our patrons, Gary, had a really great question. He was asking, how has the expanded political coverage from Teen Vogue countered the stereotypes about the interests of young women?
Yeah. Hey, Gary. So I feel so frustrated every single day because it has challenged these really basic ideas about the reality that you can care about one thing and another thing at the same time.
Right. And walk and chew gum.
You can have, that you can have serious and non-serious interests. And like, teen girls like a lot of stupid shit.
Right.
So does everyone.
Right.
Everyone likes stupid shit.
It's so true.
And you can like stupid shit and care about this country. But it amazes me that I, no offense to Gary, think I like Gary. The way Gary phrased the question is actually pretty smart. But I feel like I'm asked it in this way where it's like, so do they care?
Right.
Do they? And it, I mean, I think that there is an alienation of young people in politics. That's a reality to it, where not only is it young people are being denied access to the political conversation, they're being denied a sense of efficacy in acting on our political system. And there's not a lot of civic education. There's
right.
not a lot of, explanation of democracy as a living process.
Right.
And I feel like that's not on us, that's not on them. So, I mean, I think that there is young people, I think millennials, speaking in a huge generality, are so incredibly compassionate and accepting. And I can't wait to see what happens when that energy gets hooked up to like a newly empowered sense of citizenship.
Yeah, I completely agree. And I, you know, on the sort of like civics lesson, it's really frustrating to me that it's not being, you know, more widely taught or talked about. Like, understanding how our democracy work is fucking important. And not just in times where we have, you know, asshole in chief, but at all times, it's really important to know like how things work and how to get involved.
Absolutely. And yeah. I feel like it's presented as a kind of like a finished, you know, it's presented as if it's done.
Right.
It's sort of, you learn about it from a perspective of history, and it's,
right.
there's three branches of government, and like George Washington did something with a cherry tree, and like we're good.
And we're done. Move on. Yeah. No, it's so true. And it really is like, it's a process. Like you said, it's a living thing. And the only way that it continues is to get involved with it. I love that. And, you know, on that vein of sort of, you know, younger people and young women, your regular Teen Vogue column is called Thigh High Politics. And your most recent piece is called Fashion is Political. And I think it sort of speaks to this way that you can be interested in, you know, two things at once. How do politics and fashion intersect? I found this sort of discussion very, very interesting.
Yeah. So it's funny because I wrote that piece so long ago. Things in print take so long, and I'm a millennial, so I really like instant gratification.
Right. And hey, me so, too.
I was working on that so long ago. It was like not summer yet. I spoke to a lot of designers and breaking down really, you know, there's obvious ways. So I guess the first point I want to make is you're allowed to just like clothes and like be really into sale shopping online all the time. That's what I'm always doing in the background of my life.
I have like six tabs open at different clothing stores.
And that like filling a cart to nowhere.
Exactly.
But you're allowed to, you know, so I want to assert first, like you can have serious and non-serious interests, of course, but then fashion is political. It's so caught up in appearance and what we signal to the world and who we are. I mean, I had a really fascinating conversation with M.M. LaFleur, Tori Hohen, who is the creative designer there. And basically they outfit women who are, you know, highly successful, and they'll be in a lot of settings in sort of very literal boys clubs. And, you know, they don't want their clothes to be a point of conversation or distraction. And I mean, that breaks my heart to really think of it in such clear terms, something that I think we all kind of know. And so what this company does is they create really sleek, stylish clothes that are ninja level minimal.
Right.
And to kind of make a negative space where, you know, women are constantly being judged in what they wear. And then the other component is sustainability. The fashion industry is, you know, I don't know what the exact stats are. There's some kind of contesting of if it's the second biggest pollutant, but it's a huge pollutant.
Right.
I don't really know. Lots of pollutants, but they're a bad one. And fast fashion and those practices, I mean, those are all caught up in politics and the way those things are regulated. So, I mean, it's like expansively, just definitively political. And also I can sail shop all the time if I want to, Tucker Carlson.
Yeah, no, that's a really good point. You absolutely can. Well, yeah, I mean, like you said, it's a lot of things. It's about the environment, it's human rights, it's regulation. There are a lot of things that are sort of tied into fashion that, you know, maybe aren't, you know, immediately visible.
Definitely.
Yeah, and I love that. And like I said, I always have six tabs in different stores of things I'm never going to buy, but I like looking at.
That's how I meditate. I don't real meditate.
Right.
I just do that.
I do that, yeah. Well, and sort of, you said you wrote this piece a while ago, but I'm really interested. So what was your take on Melania Trump's shoe choice on her recent visit to Texas? Those big stilettos in that picture.
My take was that I'm really busy.
Yeah.
And I just really didn't want to talk about them because I really felt like, honestly, they were just so high. They're just so skinny and high and stiletto-y. I just felt like I was being dog whistled by that.
Right.
I felt like she was trying to get me personally to do an anti-feminist joke about them.
Right.
You know what? It's just like, I don't, but again, like I really, it's very complicated because women's fashion choices are endlessly picked over.
Right.
And then at the same time, though, our clothes matter and how they present. Like, there is a piece of it where it's like, you're really projecting being out of touch with suffering. Like, right. I'm not like, those shoes are ugly. No. They actually were really cute shoes. They like, were. They were nice.
Like, 10 out of 10 would wear.
Look, she's dressed well. Like, I'm not that liberal. Right. I'm not that progressive. You know, come on. I can admit, I can recognize that. But I think that, you know, yeah, she looks out of touch. But I just, there's so many things happening that I frankly don't think that, like, we have time to do the kind of frivolous insider baseball, like, political right. banter that we would be doing, like, Obama's tan suit even. Like, oh, we spent so much time talking about that. And, like, there are just, like, so many crises right now. Like, CNN the other day had a tweet, and it was, like, amid crisis. And I was like, oh, which one?
Yeah, y'all? Right. Like be more specific, please.
You gotta be more specific. So I don't know. Yeah. Well, wait, I want to specify in case I have some, I really actually don't identify as liberal. I'm just talking too fast. And I think my position on that is Ice-T tweeting, like, I'm not liberal. I'm just ice. And that's my formal statement on the word liberal.
That's my formal statement. I'm not liberal. Yeah. I'm just ice. I'm into that. the name of your memoir, if you will.
Yeah. Yes. Gonna write the foreword for me, I hope.
Yeah, exactly. it is interesting because there are things, you know, clothes do project who you are. And like you said, women's clothing choices, especially in the political sphere, get picked over. Like Hillary Clinton and her pantsuits and what she's wearing was like such a huge topic of discussion. Yeah. So do you think that there is a difference in the way we talk about Hillary Clinton as a female candidate versus Melania Trump being out of touch? Like, is there a split there?
I mean, I think that, like, all of the toxic women blamey stuff, it definitely bubbles up, like, when we're talking about Melania and when right. we're talking about Ivanka. And but I also don't feel like using my feminist artillery to defend these people
right.
who are complicit in so much evil. And, I mean, like, you know what? I remember so well this outlet literally on November 9th, emailed to ask me if I wanted to write a piece on how we shouldn't be shaming Melania with her nude photos.
Right.
And I was just sort of like, you know what? Yes. Like,
yeah.
No, but that's actually not on the list of 10,000 things
right.
I am actively upset about right now.
Right.
And I just, it's just, there's just like, I don't know. It is... I think especially, like, with Ivanka, it's easier to talk about because she is then also, like, trying to champion herself
right.
as a feminist and to profit off of it while actively undermining all of the values of feminism. So it's, like, sort of more difficult with Melania because right. Melania is, like, much more of a prop in the way, and she's choosing to be. Like, she's right. choosing to be voiceless. You know, and to, I think also perhaps she's savvy in that if she is so voiceless, like people project onto her, like when she grabs her hand away,
right.
you know, or she tweets like, read a book, and it's like so easy to be like, drag him. Like, it's just like, I love that. I actually think that's hilarious, but like, I think she's even getting too much credit for that shit.
Right,
too.
Right. Kind of moving on a little bit, you know, this revelation just came to light that Facebook took ad money from a Russia-based operation.
Oh my god.
I know. Like, which crisis? Be specific. But so how do you think that that speaks to the larger narrative of fake news and this idea that there's fake news and that the mainstream media is putting out all this bullshit? So like it's a very complicated situation and
I have so much to say, Devin.
Yes. Do it.
I think that the thing about fake news is it is so aggressively undermining the function of journalism,
right.
and it allows people to have even more conviction in their anti-intellectualism
the
current of affirming things by feeling like they're true instead of finding out whether they're true or having some standard of truth. I mean,
right.
it's funny, we joke about how often we're relitigating the election. I feel like we're relitigating enlightenment thinking. I'm like, what counts as true? So I think, you know, there's certainly people who are falling for outright fake news, but mm-hmm. I feel like that is a fraction of the way it's more broadly. Like, I think that there are people who would be able to maybe point and say, this looks like a fake news story, mm-hmm. but then also are writing off things in the Washington Post that they don't like and saying, is that real though? And right. I mean, I've seen it with my parents who have master's degrees and are, you know, wildly successful people who still have this block. And I think our media literacy is so low. I mean, I remember when the email probe was over, I told my mom and she's like, is that real though? and it was amazing. I mean, like, her daughter's a journalist, right. I'm telling her, and I showed it to her in the Washington Post and she still was like, well, and it's like, no, you don't, it's not choose your own adventure.
Right.
And so there's that part of it. And then the other part that I hope that we start to talk about more is, that Mark Zuckerberg is like also a villain.
Right,
You know, I think that Silicon Valley is such bullshit.
It is.
So like, we have to deal with unpacking right now a crisis of the concentration of power in a bloated pumpkin, but also like in the oligarchy of tech, because there is so much money and brain power in one little tiny literally place in some ways. And that is scary. Mm-hmm. And I think what's most frightening to me about it is that the kind of heads of state that exist in the Silicon Valley tech oligarchy purport like aesthetics of progressivism.
Right.
So outwardly, they sort of are like, DACA?
Yeah.
What? I love DACA. And it's like, yeah, we all love 800,000 hardworking young people who just want to be American, you fucking assholes. We know that you want to just like protect your property interests and your hedonism. And those are your massive wealth. I mean, if these people were in any way genuinely progressive, then they would be more concerned with the distribution of wealth that they are part of containing at such a concentrated level. And I mean, I think that is just like the surface level of like, it just shows the hypocrisy. The fact that Facebook is taking money to undermine American democracy while Mark Zuckerberg is capitalizing on this, how can we make the world a better place as an accessory, is very, very sinister. And I think that there should be more eyes on it. I mean, it's like, you know, how many balls do we need to have? I only have two eyes.
Right,
it's very hard. But I wonder how this will also change that conversation.
Yeah.
Because I think that it's an anti-democratizing force in general, and not just in terms of like Russia selling it ads, in terms of concentration of power.
Right. Well, and then there was this whole thing like, will Mark Zuckerberg run for president? I'm like, no, fuck no, stop.
That is so incredibly, you know, so I also, another thought, it's all connected, but Facebook really, 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 really controls not just the way the media we see, but the way the media is created.
Yes.
And when I was at the Huffington Post, it was one of many. So this is not like even calling them out, but they reformatted the newsroom. And I mean that literally, because there was teams that were moved to a lower floor so video could be moved up. And it was all based on an algorithm put out by Facebook that was highly inaccurate. So the entire formatting of the structure of the philosophy that fuels newsrooms, hiring practices, editorial choices, business choices, but all of it, the full 360 process of media was altered because of an inaccurate algorithm created by Facebook. So it's like, it's not just like, oh my God, your weird aunt is seeing fake news. It's like the people who write news, the people who produce information and make all of these things accessible, like the fundamental work of journalism is changing because of Facebook. And so like Mark Zuckerberg running for president is actually so, so scary.
Yeah, no, it really is. And it's hard, you know, I like to say like, embrace your technological overlords. And it's meant to be a joke, but it's meant to point out the fact we don't even realize how entrenched Facebook, Google, social media is in our life and how important it is. And it's really hard to tease that out of these larger issues. We talked to Tracy Chow a couple months ago, and she was talking about sort of what you were saying about this appearance of progressivism in tech, about how because tech is like, they're like, we wear flip-flops to work, so we don't, you know, we're not subject to the same issues that other industries or other businesses are, but that's just not true. And it's insidious.
So sinister.
Yeah.
They have their little hoodies. A lot of times, they're like distressed hoodies.
Right, that they paid $600 for.
I mean, they also, the amount of money that's happening there and like the pageantry of like performing schlubbiness is so interesting.
Yeah.
I mean, oh God, another day, another podcast.
but like, right. Oh my God.
Oh, I know. Well, again, this sort of fashion and how we choose to present ourselves is so important in in life and in politics. Silicon Valley really encapsulates that.
It definitely. That's amazingly interesting.
Yeah, I know, right? Like, Again, moving on a little bit, you've been the subject of some pretty vicious online harassment. And this is something that we, Sarah and I, get asked about a lot in terms of like being women on the internet with opinions. So how do you deal with the constant barrage of bullshit that comes at you? I mean, obviously there were some really high profile things like with Tucker Carlson and Martin Shrek. What the fuck is this? The pharma bro?
Who? I don't know.
Mean. Fuck it. Don't Google it. Who cares?
Yeah. It's really not good. And I think that I am really tough and I am shocked at how tough I am because sometimes I'll forget. I mean, it's very like boiling frog sometimes.
Yeah.
And I'll just be talking about something and I'll just say something offhand and I will see this look of pure horror in someone's face.
Yeah.
And I'm like, Oh, wow, it's hot in here. it's so, you know what? It's funny because I haven't really talked about this too much, but I think like a feminist podcast is safer because it's harder to package things as sound bites.
Right.
But, when I was first getting it, I kind of like I didn't even know how to process it because it was just so much and it was so ugly and so evil. And I think I tried to be like, well, this is ludicrous. This is, you know, almost satirical proof of the sexism that I try to fight against in my work.
Right.
Like this is a career built on an outspoken feminist perspective. Mm-hmm. Being told to shut the fuck up cunt is like just like that's my okay. Yeah, I'm doing this. I got like sick.
Yeah.
And it was real, like, I felt like my immune system was just like, nope, because I never get sick. Like, I'm incredibly healthy and I work out all the time and I'm like, I'm into it. And I just like never really get that sick like that. And it really felt like my body was just like, truly like didn't know how to process. And I feel like there's this energy, this negative energy that I don't get to say no to. And that's because it always enters my viewfinder in some way. And the thing that's, I think, makes it the hardest actually, rather than receiving it, is not being able to talk about receiving it fully. And I mean, obviously I do talk about it, but I talk about it pretty minimally. I mean, I had only written about it one time when I was responding to, the thing that I'm not sure what his name is, Michael,
who's a what's it?
He was talking about me again, saying he was going to fuck me.
Right.
And I wrote like a tweet. And then this journalist who's writing a book about him was like, you know, he would never hurt anyone. Like, you know, acting as if she was like a mediator and acting as if, and I don't want to say her name because, you know, then she'll get shit. Like, this is just endless. But she was like acting as if I was in some way like distorting the situation, but I'm responding to a man saying he is going to fuck me.
Right.
Like, how dare you? I'm not saying, oh my God, if he hurts me, first of all, I could kick his ass. It's not really about that.
Right. It's
about
not.
The also endless hordes of shit that he unleashes on me. Like the way that like him just talking about me and treating me like a plaything just sends a locust situation to my inbox. And then also like causes things to happen in my life where I have to get security situations or, you know, go to the, like, it's just really exhausting and tiring. And then to feel like I can't even be like, well, this sucks, without hearing that I'm capitalizing on it in some way. God have mercy, you think I want this? It's very, 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 very exhausting. I mean, I think that I have to learn how to just like turn it off and figure out how to actually try and compartmentalize it, which is an unhealthy kind of term, but the reality is it is so unhealthy and it does take a toll. And there really isn't like a, oh, happy ending. Here's how I learned how to do it. It's like, I have to deal with this every day. It's not over. It's not like I did this. It's like every single woman on the internet and also every single person of color and every single blah, 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 every single marginalized person that is, has something that can be targeted and shamed, but especially women, it is this overarching silencing of anyone that, you know, is expressing an opinion. And it's warping the public forum because it's like, why would you even bother?
Right.
And it is that tiring. And it's sort of like the calculus of whether expressing an opinion is worth it is totally outweighed by this gross, gross, racist, misogynistic, evil force. And I don't know that I know the answer to how we talk about combating it. And I understand that there are practicalities, but I do think that culturally speaking, we are way too quick to just be like, well, the internet is ugly. I think that we can all try to be a little bit better than that.
Oh, I completely agree. I think, you know, it kind of starts top down. Like, it's toxic masculinity, this toxic patriarchy that even allows someone to think that it's okay in some way to say that and then write it off as like a joke or it's just the internet or don't read the comments. Like, it's a very disgusting sort of soup, if you will.
It's a disgusting soup. The other quick thing I want to say too is I think also specifically it's like, then don't read it makes me crazy because I also do talk about this a lot. Like, I need Twitter for my job. I've gotten so much work from Twitter.
Right.
I promote myself as a writer. I write for, you know, if I'm writing for multiple places, I can have a following of people who are interested in my work and the work I put out. Editors see what things I'm tweeting about and ask me to write about them sometimes. Yes. They see my interest. They know my beat in a really specific way. Like, this is not something I do for fun or to like make my brain feel like it's bleeding, which it also is, but it is both of those things too. It's really, really important for my career. So don't just tell me to leave. I have enough. There's enough ways that men have an advantage on me that I'm not going to just cut off another limb.
Right. Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, you're right. What? You're not supposed to be there. Like, that's the solution. That's not a fucking solution.
No,
that's ridiculous. Yeah. That it is really frustrating. And you know, if you figure out how to deal with it, please let us know.
I'll call back in.
Call back in and just tell everyone. And yeah, so on that really depressing note, at the end of every episode of our podcast, we like to do a gratitude check to take stock of the good things that are happening in these dark times. So what are you grateful for right now? And it can be anything, big or small, political or personal.
I have a really serious positive thing, which is, I mean, people are also amazing.
Right.
And I think that people go out of their way to send me really, really kind, positive messages and just to be like, hey, here are vibes. And sometimes, and I love this so much, they'll be like, here are vibes. You don't have to take the time to respond, girl. Like, they're actually just like, I don't want to cost you energy. I just want to give it to you.
Right.
And I think that that is so, so amazing. And like, I hate that the scales on how that affects me versus how the really nasty stuff affects me are so uneven. But you know what? It helps so much. And I really see it in such a concerted effort. And I also would encourage anybody who's listening, like, if you have a writer you like, especially if she's a woman, go and be like, I loved this. Like, if you love something, tell them, like, give the good vibes, because like the bad ones are coming and coming and coming and not stopping. And so I'm so, so grateful for that. And I mean, I think like also I am still optimistic about how this moment, you have to be, because it really is so hard. And like the other day I was a little tipsy and I was like, wait, I'm forgetting one of the crises. Which is it? And then I was like, oh, it's Russia. But
Russia.
I was like, it's been so long.
Yeah.
So it's been like at least 24 hours. So it's, but you know, there is so much going on and it really is so much worse than we ever, ever could have imagined.
Yes.
But at the same time, it is impossible. It is impossible to not care on some level. And I do think there is a force awakening and it is continuing to show up. This is not a moment anymore. I mean, I remember like in the Women's March was framed as like, is it a fad? And I mean, we have to hope that people will continue to stay active and vigilant and, you know, maybe be involved as an understanding what it means to be a politically active citizen. And I'm not saying that from a self-righteous place, because I was totally like, Obama's my dad, it's fine. And everything changed. And I think like, hopefully it's an effective wake-up call and not just the end of everything.
Right. Well, Sarah and I like to say this a lot. We say, you know, if anything good came out of this, and we're really searching for a silver lining here, but it's really open. It's really made every woman I know, most people I know, just unleash their inner, like, feminist, I don't give a fuck self. And it's great.
Was that your tweet? That's so true.
Yeah.
That's so true. That's such a good, yes. I saw that and I was like, I think I said yes out loud.
Yeah.
It's so true.
Yeah.
I am noticing that with so many women. Honestly, I think I'm noticing that with a lot of just people in general. I mean, I think it has like a feminist fire to it.
Yeah.
But I also think like it's amazing. Like people are really realizing their potential, right. And I hope that they that we continue to apply that. It with a compassionate component and with some, you know, element of fighting back, which doesn't have to be volunteering. It could just be like thinking about like what mark are we leaving right. in this world and like what, how, who are we? And like using that fire, but totally also like so many women in my life have like gotten hotter. And I think like everyone is just like, I need to sweat. And like, yes. It is working on my ass personally. My ass looks so good. Thank you. I'm not thanking him for that. Fuck that actually.
Fuck that.
But it does look good. It
yeah.
does look good.
No, I totally get that. No. So that's a great gratitude check.
Thankful for my own ass.
You know what? Yeah. I think that's great. I think that's part of this. Like be thankful for who you are and like what you're doing for yourself. Like, I think that's great. Yeah. So I just want to say thank you again to Lauren for joining us today. You can follow her on Twitter at Lauren Duca and read her regular column, Thigh High Politics, on Teen Vogue. It was great speaking to you, Lauren. This was so fun. And I'm so happy that I got to do this with you. Even
Me
though Sarah's
too.
Not here.
I know. Okay. Shout out to Sarah.
Yes.
Make sure you tweet my column this week. No, I'm just kidding. Thank you guys so much.
All right, we are going to get into our gratitude checks. Devin, would you like to go first?
Yes, I would love to. So the first thing that I'm grateful for, it's a person, and her name is Nancy motherfucking Pelosi.
I didn't know that was her middle name.
It is. Oh, my God. She and I have the same middle name, motherfucking.
That's amazing. Mine's Anne.
Yeah.
So boring.
So boring. But we didn't have really time to get into this story, which broke kind of late, and we want to talk about DACA more in depth, but a little bit of context. So Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer basically walked into Trump's office and came out with the deal of the century, got everything they wanted, and gave up nothing. And you know how that happened? Nancy fucking Pelosi. That's what happened. I mean, so I just want to say that there's been a lot of shitting on Nancy Pelosi as of late. You know, the progressives wanted to replace her. You know, they're like, we need someone new and fresh blood.
New blood.
I know. And the media...
Should be a young white man's blood.
Yeah, come on. you know, the media slammed her as ineffectual and self-aggrandizing, and she just hasn't merited any of that with a response. And just, like, general life advice... Don't come for Nancy Pelosi in general, right? Just no. She's the reason that the ACA passed in the first place. Because you know she went to all of the Democrats in the House and said, fuck you, fuck your feelings, you're voting for this and you're going to like it. Or at least that's what you're going to tell the fucking press.
Yep.
That's it.
Pretty much.
We're done.
Yeah, that's pretty much how it went down.
Yeah, exactly. Because you know not all Democrats were like, yay. No. But she was like, this is happening and you're going to shut the fuck up about it. And so basically what happened is she and Chuck Schumer went in and they got Trump to agree to tie Harvey relief funding to raising the debt ceiling and funding the government for 3 months. So until the end of the year, which takes a high value Republican bargaining chip off of the table for the remainder of the year and forcing Congress to revisit government funding and the debt limit in December. Why is this awesome? So according to Politico, which explained it very nicely, quote, but the Wednesday deal still means that Congress will have to raise the debt ceiling, negotiate a massive $1 trillion spending bill, and potentially hash out a deal on immigration all at once or in quick succession. And they've lost all their leverage.
Ouch.
Because now they don't have the Harvey relief. So,
yeah, that's super awkward when you have both chambers of Congress and the White House to get kind of had by the Democrats.
Seriously. And you know, because Trump is such a good fucking negotiator. Like,
right.
I do not doubt the fact that Nancy Pelosi went in there and was scary as hell. Like,
no, I think you think you're a good negotiator and then you meet Nancy Pelosi. I think there's a, like, what I kept coming back to when people wanted to boot her out of the speaker's chair, the minority leader's seat, is it's Nancy Pelosi and she is in her own words, a master fucking legislator.
Yeah.
Fucking is my own insertion into that.
But she is.
But, she is. She knows what she's doing.
Right.
She's 80 years old. I mean, this is not her first rodeo.
No.
There's no young white guy who's going to step into those shoes, those high heels for that matter.
Right.
And get anything done.
I know.
Anything.
I always love, one of my favorite tidbits about her is that she didn't run for office until she was in her 50s, and she had raised five children. Five children. Mm-hmm. She has a bullshit meter finely tuned. Like, there is no way. And the little nugget from a top Republican close to leadership is my favorite part of this whole story. Quote, Dems bluffed their ways into total victory, to which I say, see my first point about not coming for Nancy Pelosi in general.
Yeah, I hear you. That's a great gratitude check. I love that.
So she rules, Trump rules. I'm going to stand by that. So my second one, I always try to pick at least one a week that's not political, that has nothing to do with anything. So the New York Times has released another beautiful interactive piece of the web about how rock isn't dead. It's just ruled by women. So they made a Spotify playlist, and it's excellent. And they also had a roundtable discussion with the artist featured on the list, which is also excellent. So the tagline of their discussion is, guitars may seem to matter less than ever, but just beneath the mainstream, dozens of female bands are making some of the most urgent, politically relevant music around. To which I say, Leda.
Yeah.
Always. That's always been the case.
Always.
The article goes on to say, but as we've spoken among ourselves about how the music that most excites us, we have consistently marveled at how much outstanding rock music is being made by female and non-binary performers who work just below the surface of the mainstream. Which, like, calm down. It's not that surprising that women can also be good musicians and good rock stars, but I appreciate the sentiment. I appreciate the fact that you appreciate it. But the whole thing is worth a read, and, you know, kind of exploring and playing with it. And they've got lots of pictures and music and it just, and all sorts of stuff about women and non-binary people in rock and roll. And it's a nice break from all of the political bullshit coming at us full speed. And I cannot stress enough how great this playlist is. So if you need if you need some good, like, get up on a chair and, like, dance around in your underwear music, 10 out of 10 would recommend.
All right. So, I'm going to download that.
Yeah, right. So that's me. So, Julie, what are you grateful for?
Okay. So we've touched on the Charlottesville to DC march a few times, mm-hmm. but having just wrapped it up a few hours ago, literally right before we started recording, and I'm barely dried off and I'm tired and sore. And
Julie's the real rock star here.
Oh no, I'm just like, I'm disgusting. Like, I haven't showered yet, but I put dry clothes on, and I was telling Devin before we started recording, I did put pants on, which was an achievement after the day. But anyway, back to the real gratitude check. Getting to spend the last few days with this march, marching against white supremacy, is what I am just so, so grateful for right now. It was a mixture of experienced organizers, kind of shell-shocked Charlottesville residents, activists new and seasoned, and a whole hodgepodge of others picked up along the way. I mean, some celebrities kind of joined the ride. Mark Ruffalo was there for a few days. There were two actors from Mad Men that I walked with for like 2 hours yesterday and had no idea who they were because I have never seen the show. But they were, I mean, they were all in. Right. Piper Perabo, who
I love her.
You know her.
I love her.
Coyote Ugly fans Coyote Ugly. From the early 2000s will appreciate.
Also a movie, I'm sorry, this is so off topic, but she was also in a movie with Lena Headley from Game of Thrones called Imagine Me and You, which I recommend. I'm sorry, continue.
Okay. All right. Judah Friedlander joined today. So
fun.
The famous people are not the point here, but they joined in and they kind of just
went along.
Got on board with the cause, which was great. And one thing the march itself did so well that I really, really appreciated was the centering of people of color. Right. Those who are the most impacted and harmed by white supremacy should get to lead the march to confront white supremacy.
Absolutely.
And they should get to do that with a ton of white allies at their backs.
Right.
People of color have always led. But this time they got to visibly lead with white allies. You know, we always had them at the people of color at the front, white allies behind them to symbolically show and literally show that white allies had their backs. They're behind them. They're following their lead. And the white folks there, for the most part, were really, really respectful of that and ready to take the support role. And I think that's something that's really needed right now and always from white allies, that willingness to kind of take the back seat, let communities of color lead. Don't try to center yourselves.
Right.
Listen to direction, spread the message, put your bodies on the line, because white people's bodies are typically in less danger from police, from white supremacists, from other dangers you face along the way. So it was really heartening to see so many white allies come out, but also on top of that, just so incredibly heartening to see these wonderful, wonderful women of color leading this march, organizing, walking 118 miles through shin splints and gunmen and blisters and hunger and everything else that they faced along the way to get to DC and, you know, finish up there. And it was so inspiring. And I was really grateful to be a part of it for a few days.
Yeah, that's amazing. Honestly, it's really beautiful. So we have a couple of listener gratitude checks. Julie, do you want to do the first one?
Sure. The first listener gratitude check is from Abby. And Abby says, "Hey, Devin and Sarah, I'm Abby from Minneapolis, and I had to share my recent local gratitude check. Julius DeRoma, owner of the Minneapolis Bar Club
Jaeger.
Yeah. Sorry, been a long time since my last Jaeger bomb.
Yeah, right.
Was outed on August 29th for donating $500 to David Duke, as in, yes, the ex-KKK Grand Wizard David fucking Duke's 2016 Senate campaign. Just 3 days later, the staff of the club had the guts to walk out on their jobs and subsequently make Club Jaeger close. Oh, that's so awesome.
That's so good.
Standing up for equality is admirable, but it's next level to walk away from your income for it. I'm proud of my city's zero tolerance attitude for intolerance and the hope it empowers more people to persist in their resistance. I'll be raising my glass of Pinot Noir to them. Also, if you'd like to include it in your action items, we will.
Yes.
There's a GoFundMe for the employees, https://www.gofundme.com. This is a long link, so hang in there. We'll put the whole thing in the
show notes.
In the action. Yep. TZSDPY-club-jaeger-exit-fund. And again, that will be in the show notes if you want to refer to it later.
Yes. Also, what kind of douchebag names their bar Club Jaeger? Like, are you 12? Are you a 12-year-old who's like, drinking is cool and I'm going to name my club Club Jaeger?
It would seem the kind of person who donates to David Duke's Senate campaign.
Yeah, good point. Good point. That makes more sense now.
Seems to be a Venn diagram that's a full circle.
That's just a full circle. So good. So the next one is from Misha. And full disclaimer, Misha is my bestie, but she did post this in a Facebook group. And it's something that I'm also grateful for right now. She said, "Right now, I'm thankful for firefighters risking their lives to try to put out the fires destroying our beloved forests, trails, and homes throughout the country. I have the pleasure of knowing a few of the men fighting the Latuna fire in SoCal, and they are some of the most humble men and women I've ever met. When thanked for their service, they just smile and say it's a pleasure to keep us all safe." It's lovely.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a great one. We've been, you know, following the fire from the East Coast with just horror and shock. And you see these pictures and it looks like walking into mortar. I've never seen anything like that.
You know,
growing up on the East Coast, we don't have wildfires or anything of that magnitude here, and it's just awful and really,
honestly,
really scary.
Even growing up with fires and wildfires, this is a particularly, like you said, like Mordor-esque, like it is scary. So
I mean, seeing it right outside the city limits is very scary, and it's really good to know that the firefighters are in decent spirits and still okay doing their work, and we thank them and respect them.
Yes.
Our last one is Nephi. She says, "This week, the generally dickwadian senator, Cory Gardner, has signed on to support the DREAM Act."
Yay!
And that's great.
That
when we
great.
Have dickwads do good things,
hey,
we're grateful.
We're grateful. It's great.
All right. We are on to the Hellion of the Week. Devin, do you want to give us the honorable mention?
Yes. So the honorable mention this week is actually one of our own listeners, fellow Hellion, Melissa Taylor. So she and another woman named Erica Rosenthal organized members of their community to speak out against their mayor's offensive comments. So she posted this on Facebook and she said, "Just on my way to start planning a meeting to overthrow my small town's mayor. He tweeted 2 days ago comparing Confederate statues to George Washington. He has since doubled down. Now everyone's angry and meeting to see how we can censure him. How's your Friday going? So Melissa also said, so then she posted again and said, we did it. Like, we went to this meeting and there was a video of the whole thing and her giving a speech. So she also said to me when I asked her if I could share this, she said, yes. But speaking with Erica, the other woman, we want to point out that this was a group effort by mostly moms. There were a lot of standout speakers who came together. Presley called out our mayor for blocking people on Facebook, Magana for talking about diversity and hate crimes. And all of us have day jobs and kids. It was a huge group effort. So I think that was great. At the city council meeting, she said, quote, to publicly defend the support of these statues was so shocking to me. To compare people who are trying to get rid of and not support traitors of this nation, to pass it off as freedom of speech or remember history, is frankly disgusting. Is this the town that I want to live in? Is this who I want representing me or my family? History only repeats itself when we change the narrative. And it was such a badass moment to watch her say this at a city council meeting. And it takes guts to stand up like that in front of your elected officials. And it
absolutely.
Was, yeah. And it was just such a cool, badass example of people standing up in their communities and resisting not only Trump and his administration, and these are more exasperated air quotes, but all forms of oppression and racism at every level, at a local level. And it just warms my cold feminist heart. Like, I love
it. Amen.
It was so great. I just thought it was so wonderful. So
that's awesome. Yeah, good for them.
I know. It was good. So do you want to tell everyone who our Hellion of the Week is?
All right. Our Hellions of the Week are the attorney generals. Oh, we love attorney generals when they're good, right? In 15 states and the District of Columbia, who are filing a lawsuit to protect DACA recipients.
Right.
So New York, Connecticut, Delaware, Hawaii, Illinois, Iowa, Massachusetts, New Mexico, North Carolina, Oregon, Pennsylvania, Rhode Island, Vermont, Virginia, woo, Washington, and the District of Columbia all signed on to this suit.
And I just want to say really fast, where the hell is California? Becerra needs to get it together. Okay?
Yeah. Come on. You're not Hellion of the Week,
pull
California.
Pull it together. Yeah. Also, fun side note is that in the original suit there were a bunch of AGs who were threatening to sue over DACA if Trump didn't end it. It was
nine.
And then the 10th person was actually the governor of Iowa, whose AG is now on this suit. So, fun fact.
Fuck it.
Yeah, right? Fuck it.
So the lawsuit claims that Trump's decision was, quote, motivated at least in part by a discriminatory motive, unquote, against Mexicans, who are the largest beneficiary of the program. It points to his statements from the 2016 presidential campaign. The attorneys general also argue the government has not guaranteed DACA recipients that their application information will not be used, quote, for purposes of immigration enforcement, including identifying, apprehending, detaining, or deporting non-citizens, unquote. And again, like we talked about that earlier, the sort of shaky wording in the statement that said, oh no, we're not going to use their information, but we'll hand it over to ICE if they want it.
Right.
So this is a good move. This is a really good move.
Yeah.
And we've also seen with the Muslim ban that Trump's statements from the 2016 presidential campaign can be effectively used against him in court.
Oh yeah. Intent matters. So
yeah,
I mean, it's hard because it does kind of look like an uphill battle because the president usually has wide jurisdiction over immigration policy. But we saw with the Muslim ban that just because there is wide jurisdiction doesn't mean that judges are going to go along with it. And basically these AGs, though, are making the case that it is a state issue as the citizens affected by the DACA policy, and if they were to leave, could bring about economic damage to the states if removed.
So, New York Attorney General Eric Schneiderman, the lead lawyer listed in the suit, yay Schneiderman, said it's clear that President Trump's DACA repeal would cause huge economic harm to New York and that it's driven by President Trump's personal anti-Mexican bias. And this is a little mirror of the supposed deadline imposed by the 10 attorney generals in Republican-held states who were threatening to sue if Trump didn't end the DACA program.
Right. Yeah, I mean, apparently that lawsuit was one of the reasons why Trump said in his official statement that he had to do this DACA thing now. He said that it was a legal deadline and they wouldn't be able to defend it in court. But apparently this lawsuit is like, it doesn't, he's like, yeah, it's fine. It's fine. No one worry. No one worry about that. Like, what?
Bullshit.
Bullshit. It's so ridiculous. But yeah, I mean, good move on those, you know, 15 AGs and District of Columbia. And I will say it again, Becerra, move it, put it together.
Yeah, get it together, California.
All right, Julie. So last but not least, we have some action items for our listeners. So what is up first?
Okay. So we're very DACA focused this episode. So our first action item and our second one as well is around DACA resource info. Your DACA is valid until its expiration date. No new DACA applications will be accepted. DACA issuances and work permits expiring between now and March 5th, 2018 must be submitted for renewal by October 5th, 2017. Advance parole to travel abroad is no longer available. Any pending applications for advance parole will be processed, and that's via Raymond Braun.
Right, will not be processed. I'm sorry, that was a typo. Yeah, they'll not be processed and all the fees will be refunded. So it's not going to happen. So that's just a little bit of information about, you know, DACA and what's going on, just to clarify. There's also a great resource, so their second action item, called the Dream Act Toolkit. So that's dreamacttoolkit.org. And so they have resources to call and tweet at your representatives. From the website, they say, quote, "The key lawmakers below," and they have a whole list, "are the swing votes we need to secure passage of the Dream Act with no compromises and provide Dreamers with a pathway to permanent legal status and citizenship. Call and tweet at them now to let them know Dreamers are not a bargaining chip." So that's so important. They have a whole bunch from all the different states, and they've got these great graphics you can use, and it's a really great resource. There's also an article in the LA Times, and we'll link to it in the show notes, about how to find help if you're a Dreamer. They've broken it down into sections. So if you're a student, if you're a parent of a Dreamer, or if you need help in multiple languages. So that's also a good resource if you need help with that.
Yeah, that's great. And our last action item is to support Seaville to DC's extended nonviolent direct action. So the link is pretty long to share verbally. Their website is Seaville2DC.us. They are, as of now, as of today, once they arrived in DC, they are planning to, now that the 118-mile march is over, they're going to occupy space at Farragut Square about two blocks from the White House, at least until the March for Racial Justice on September 30th. So you can support their efforts and help keep them fed and safe by going to Seaville2DC.us, click the donate button, or you can buy a benefit t-shirt and tell everyone you were there without having to hurt your legs or get your feet wet. No blisters, shin splints necessary. If you feel inclined to do that, go ahead and do it.
No, that's a great one. So a lot of information today. Julie, thank you so much for coming and helping. And this was so great.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm so honored to join you again. I wish Sarah were here too. I am obviously sad that the circumstances are such that she can't be here with us. And I am so excited that she will be back at full strength soon.
Yes, yes. But so thank you to all of our listeners. We will hopefully see you on Monday. Hopefully Sarah will be back with us. And if not, we will see you soon. For more information on today's episode, please visit our website at www.hellbentpodcast.com. You'll find the articles we've discussed as well as additional resources. You can follow us on Twitter and Instagram at HellbentPod, and you can follow us on Facebook at facebook.com/HellbentPodcast. We also have a fan group called Dickwads Be Gone, which you can find on Facebook.
Please listen on iTunes and rate us 5 stars, because that's just like the rules of feminism. We also have a Patreon, and you can find us at patreon.com/HellbentPodcast. You can support us for as little as $1 a month, and for $5 a month, you get access to exclusive content, mini podcasts, and behind-the-scenes looks at the making of Hellbent.